Hello, and welcome to the Above Average Irrelevance podcast. This is episode 12. Today is Wednesday, April 27th. I'm Matt Weaver, and I'm here with Scott Nelson. Hi, Scott.
Good morning.
How's it going?
Good.
Well, I know we just started recording, but I'm already halfway through my coffee because we've been chatting here without recording.
Yeah.
For a while now.
I wasted all my good material, so I'm just going to sit here in silence.
It'll just be me talking about stuff until we're done. So let's start with an answer to a question we asked last week about Apple and the FBI and how much. Yeah, and it seems FBI Director James Comey made some references this past week that seem to indicate that they paid at least as much as he's expected to earn in the remainder of his time as director of the FBI, which the internet has figured out to be $1.3 million, which is actually not bad salary for being the director of the FBI, it seems like. But it's a lot of money to pay to get into a phone that contains no data. I mean, I suppose you could argue, well, now they have verified that it contains no data.
But maybe it was worth the $1 million just for the FBI to win or to have a winning out, right? Like, we're not going to turn the screws on Apple, but, you know, we found this other way. We won anyway. I think that's what they were buying with the $1 million.
Well, there was that other case.
Saving face.
There was that other case in New York that they were trying to get Apple. Yeah, you know, the FBI was trying to get a court order to compel Apple to unlock a phone. And just a few days ago, the FBI said, nope, never mind. We got somebody to give us the passcode. We're fine. So, I don't know. It's another... Some commentary I have read suggests that perhaps the FBI took a look again and said, oh, we're going to lose this one too. Let's not get a ruling that's directly against us and escape this one too.
So I didn't look into the context of him saying that. Do you know the exact circumstances under which he said that? And the reason I ask is I wonder if this was a pre-calculated thing. Like, he knew someone's going to ask me how much you paid. Here's what I'm going to say. I'm going to have this vague, you know, sentence.
It was at some conference he was going to speak at where people were going to be allowed to ask
questions. Or was it an off-the-cuff thing? Did he come up with that off-the-cuff? Because then it's very different. I mean,
I don't know. Perhaps he's astoundingly good at math. If you said, tell me how much money you're going to make in the next 7 years and 4 months or whatever.
So that's what I'm wondering. If it was actually calculated. So, you know, if people, you know, it's public record how much I make. If people do the math, they'll know that it's $1.3 million.
I wonder
if they thought about that or if it was just more money than I'll ever make, you know, kind of thing.
So you
think it's accurate?
I think it was a clever way for him to put a scale.
Without saying a big number.
Yeah.
Out loud.
Yeah.
Well, another question answered in the case, and it's...
So there you go. That you can apparently make a lot of money as a gray hat for the FBI.
Other thing that's interesting to me is what, you know, like the invoice for that hack. Was it just a single line item and it was, you know, tell you how to hack an iPhone, $1,375,000, yada, yada. I mean, what goes into determining the price of that hack? It has to just be an arbitrary number.
It's Clipwell.
Right? I mean, they aren't saying it took us X number of hours at a consulting price of X number of dollars. Like,
no. It's probably, you know, it's a one-line invoice that, you know, consulting fees for job number and then some job reference number, case number or something, right? And the number is probably what the hackers thought they could get the FBI to pay, right? Like, this is clearly a what will the market bear sort of thing. Just like these distributed denial of service attack extortion attempts, have you seen? Like the Cloak VPN service last week got an email from these people that said, you know, pay us, I don't know, 10 Bitcoins or whatever, or on Monday we're going to launch a denial of service attack against you and, you know, you'll go out of business. And, you know, they thought about it for a day and then they came out publicly on their blog and said, you know, there are people trying to do this to us. This is what they told us. And we're going to flip them the proverbial bird because this isn't right. If they actually launch a denial of service attack, you know, we apologize in advance for any difficulties with the service you might have. And Monday came and went and nothing came from it because, as it turns out, it's just easier to make the threat and ask the companies to pay whatever it is you think they'll pay and then not do it otherwise, right? This will only work for a while, of course, until right. everybody learns that, oh,
there's going to be no follow through.
There's going to be no follow through. But, you know, apparently like 100 companies got this thing. Several paid up, a few didn't. If you only get 20% of the companies each paying you 10 Bitcoins each, well, that,
free money.
It, yeah, for the cost of sending an email.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Hmm.
So, I am actually using a free trial of Cloak right now. But I like it. It works well. And they appear to be stand-up guys, not putting up with internet trolls. So I'm willing to give them my money, I think.
Cool.
All right. So the first item we had on our list was about ibuprofen. So you and I both go to the gym and do the various things that we do in the gym to try to make there be less of us. Do you take ibuprofen or Tylenol or some pain medication either preemptively or regularly after you exercise?
So I take ibuprofen pretty regularly after exercise. I never take pain relief medication like that before I work out or before I run or anything like that, because I kind of disagree with that. Like, I don't want to hide the pain. If I'm working out and I'm sore or I have some sort of pain, I feel I need to understand, you know, the degree to which it is bad.
Right.
So I don't make it worse. So I generally think it's a bad, I mean, this article talked about runners who, what did they call it? Vitamin I, how they just live constantly on ibuprofen to run through the pain. I think masking your pain when you're working out is probably a bad idea. Doesn't that just seem like a bad idea logically?
It does. Pain is...
isn't it your body telling you to...
Yeah, it's an important feedback mechanism. But the interesting bit was now there's you know, a scientific study that says, as it turns out, it makes no bearing on your recovery,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, did this article sway you at all?
It didn't. I have always used the argument, you know, and when I encourage other people to take ibuprofen, the argument that it's helping with inflammation, even if you don't feel you need it for the pain, that it's helping reduce inflammation. And I was always under the, you know, the impression that that was true. This article doesn't seem to think that is true.
At least they couldn't find a statistical relevance to it. Your own mileage may vary. I generally don't take it. Sometimes I'm just sore.
Yeah.
And that's just how it is. But I guess I kind of view that as a natural consequence of trying to lift something heavy or doing those last couple of squats or whatever it was, you know, whatever part of my body is sore. I can almost always think back to what I did yesterday or 2 days ago and be like, oh yeah, that's what did it for me. So
I guess I don't take ibuprofen in order to work out. I take it in order to, you know, lead the rest of my life in the face of working out. Right. So I worked out really hard this morning and now, you know, my quads are really sore and I got to walk around for the rest of the day, or I'm going to be sitting at my desk for the rest of the day. I take the ibuprofen just so I'm not distracted, you know, by the soreness throughout the day. Same thing when I'm going to sleep at night. lots of times if I have something that's particularly sore, especially if it's like my shoulders, it will wake me up at night. You know, like when I turn to one side or the other, you know, a pain will actually wake me up. Whereas if I don't feel pain, I won't wake up. So I feel like taking ibuprofen at night helps me sleep.
I could get behind the help me sleep portion simply because, you know, for better or worse, you still need to be able to get up the following day and be a productive citizen. You know, if somebody's going to give you a paycheck, the I slept like crap because I worked out is probably not an acceptable argument. But I guess I'd challenge you to only take it at night if you think you're going to need it. Just live with the soreness, right? If you worked out and later that day your legs are sore because you're sitting at your desk all day, that's really an argument to get up and walk around and try to work out the lactic acid and help remove the soreness sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
So. Nah, you're giving me the...
What am I going to do with these massive bottles of ibuprofen that I buy at Costco? Well, I have like 1,000 ibuprofens to go through, so maybe next year I'll...
It doesn't instantly go bad. It's not like it's lettuce or something like that. Right?
That stuff goes bad surprisingly fast, though. Do you... You know, I don't get a lot of headaches. I never have headaches. So aside from taking ibuprofen for pain, you know, I have aspirin and Tylenol and all kinds of other stuff in my... cupboard, and when I go to get something, it's almost always expired because they really only last for what, like 18 months, a year, something like that.
Yeah, I have almost all of those drugs, right? You know, Advil and Tylenol, and you know, sometimes I keep Excedrin around, but all of that stuff I keep around for my guests because it is rare. That I use. Not never. Occasionally, you know, you just have a headache and you just, it's like, man, I really need to get my brain back for a few hours. And so I'll take something. Or if you're sick and you have a fever, you know, if I'm going to go to sleep, I find if I take a couple of Tylenol, you know, break the fever, I can get a few hours of sleep, which is helpful for the try to recover from your sickness. But I just, you know, I buy the little tiny bottles because they expire.
It's going to expire and you're going to throw it away.
You know, I just throw it away and let, just get a little, another little bottle because several of my friends, for whatever reason, they just have different attitudes towards taking those things. Mm. And they, you know, they have a little headache or something. Oh, do you have some Tylenol or some ibuprofen? Yep. It's up in the cabinet, you know. Yeah. Okay, let's talk about this next thing. Did you read this?
About the clock?
The 10,000 year clock.
Yeah.
So there was a video and then... Mm-hmm. This is kind of crazy. Like, it's a really kind of neat idea when you start to think about it. My little engineer mind starts to think, oh, how do you make something last for 10,000 years? Turns out, it's hard.
So I had watched the video and started reading about it and stuff. Before I came across the name Jeff Bezos.
Yeah.
So, and then when I saw his name on it, it made more sense because the whole time I'm kind of thinking like, where's all this money coming from? You know, like
who's crazy enough to give you this money?
Who's going to spend these, you know, tens of millions of dollars it's going to take to build this clock, which is really cool and is a great idea. But I'm like, you know, this guy was like, was he like an IBM engineer where he worked somewhere, well, I can't remember now, but he was just an engineer at a big corporation, and it's like, where is he getting these millions of dollars?
He graduated from MIT, right? He was a big brain at MIT, and then worked somewhere.
Yeah,
I forget exactly where it was, but then he had this, you know, crazy idea, right? As opposed to trying to figure out how to build something, you know, faster and cheaper, which he'd basically been doing for the entirety of his life. He's like, how do I build something that lasts forever? And the most amazing thing about it is just changing your mindset. How do I get something to last a really long time?
Mm-hmm.
The idea can, you know, you can move that laterally to lots of different things, right? How would I have an iPhone that lasted even 10 years, right? Well, probably can't, right? But it's an interesting thought experiment. You know, how do I get things in my life to last?
Yeah, so the thing about a clock where everything is mechanical, right, is a huge advantage over something that's digital or electronic.
Yeah, but it's kind of pseudo-digital, right? Because a lot of the calculations that this clock does are, you know, mechanical bit adders, right? So it's digital logic carried out in the mechanical realm to calculate the things that it calculates, right? Which includes the time, obviously, it's a clock, right? And then the date, and then it's going to calculate the orbits of the various planets that are visible with the naked eye from Earth. So not all of the, are we at 8 or 9 planets? No, 8 plus a dwarf planet. I don't know what Pluto is. I'm sorry.
It's the planet formerly known as Pluto. The Pluto formerly known as a planet.
There you go. So it's going to calculate that stuff. And then, you know, there's some chimes that it plays.
So this is a massive multi-room sized piece of machinery, right?
That they're building.
It's being built into a cliff face.
Yeah. I would love to go and visit it once they've get it installed.
Yeah, and so then the interesting thing is, you know, something special is going to happen every at the 1 year turnover, at the 10 year, at the 100 year, and I think it said like
at there's the 1,000 year.
There's a cuckoo that comes out at the 100 year, and so immediately I thought, oh, I would love to go see that, but not going to happen because I'm going to be dead.
Well, you can always hope for advances in medical science.
There you go.
Right?
But that was the cool thing. And so like it said that then, you know, they aren't even going to design what happens at like
the 1,000 year,
1,000 year and 10,000 year, thinking that, you know, future generations will take up, you know, they're providing some sort of a mechanical interface into the clock. So future generations can design what will happen at those milestones, which is really cool.
It's really cool, but I have to admit, in reading through it, my mind immediately went to Planet of the Apes, right? Like, you can imagine 1,000 years from now, there are going to be people worshiping this thing that have no understanding of what it is that it does. They've only learned about it through empirical means, right? And they don't understand why
it was just like some guy's hobby project.
That's right. And then we're going to get 9,500 years into the future, right? And the existence of this clock, which is going to stop working at 10,000 years, is going to be one of the predictions of Nostradamus that civilization is going to end, right? Like, you can just imagine all the crazy stuff that future humans are going to think about this thing, because, you know, some calamity will occur and all of the context, all of the history around this clock is going to be lost. And then its existence is going to be reinterpreted as something truly bizarre.
I couldn't really find good, you know, if you go to the website, it's a very sparse website.
Yeah.
And the updates, the last update was December of 2011. Yeah. So I kind of wonder, like, looking online, I couldn't really find a good update of what's happening today with the clock.
There's a foundation called The Long Now, I think is what it's called.
Which sounds kind of like a cult, actually.
It does. But it's this, so I think this idea about making a clock that lasts for a long time has inspired other people to think about what other things can we do that have a very long timeline, this very long thinking. So I think this foundation, The Long Now, started up, and it's funding other things besides just this clock. And so if you find that website, they have some other bits about the clock and other things they're doing too. But I don't know. You know, this guy started thinking about this in like, what, 1989 or something like that. I came across it. It intrigued me. Speaking of other things that came across, The Atlantic ran this photo essay, a look back at 1986, right? Basically 30 years ago. And there were some amazing photos in there, right? Lots of them are pretty cool. Some of the ones that really struck me, right? Because 1986, I was 10. So that's old enough to have some memory of the time and probably some of the largest things going on in the universe I was vaguely aware of at 10, right? At 10, you're probably watching MTV and doing all those other things, right? But like there's a picture in there of Madonna and Sean Penn, because I believe they had been married or just about to be married around about then. And when you're 10 and you're looking at 20-somethings, they look old to you, right? And so now, being older and looking back at them, they just look so young.
Mm-hmm. Look like teenagers.
They do, but so some of that stuff was kind of astonishing, right? And then, of course, it starts with a picture of Mr. T and Boy George, which screams, 1986 to me.
Did you read the caption of that? It says, the singer Boy George poses with Mr. T during the filming of an episode of the television show A-Team.
Yeah.
Did Boy George guest star on the A-Team?
Probably.
I need to seek out that episode.
It's probably on Netflix.
You know, that's one of those shows I watched as a kid and I have never sought it out, as an adult. I wonder if it'd be good.
No, don't. So I sought out Knight Rider, right? And I watched all four seasons of it. And, you can see, as an adult, you can see the elements of the show that kind of made it popular. And you can see the things that your young self really enjoyed about that show. But, of course, you can witness all of the stupidity and formulaic crap and bad dialogue. Everything about the show just screams disaster, right? Like, it's the type of show that you wouldn't make today simply right. because the bar is higher. And like most shows of that era, it went one season too far. Like the last season of the show is really terrible, right? Like it's clear that they were out of gas, in terms of the writing.
So to speak.
And so they had that last season and the ratings plummeted and then they took it off the air. But one of the things about that show that I totally did not pick up on as a little kid, but was literally the best part about that show is in the very first season, there was the woman who was the engineer in charge of the car. And I do not remember what her character's name was or the actress that played her, right? But the writing of the show was such that, Michael Knight, right? David Hasselhoff's character was always trying to be friendly and otherwise, pursue this woman in a playful way, right? And she was always aloof and totally saw through all of Michael Knight's charms. And so every episode, there's some little thing where she's fixing something on the car, right? And she has this very adult relationship with Kit, the car, right? And Michael is always trying to have his boyish charms work on her, and she is always shooting him down. And it is hilarious. Like, it is literally the funniest thing in the show. And then in the second season, the writers decided that was apparently not acceptable, and so her character was out. That actress was even out. And they brought in some other actress who always kind of, responded in a giggly sort of way to all of Michael Knight's boyish charms, which was way less interesting, right? And then eventually she was out and the original girl was back, but her relationship was, there was less cat and mouse. She wasn't as aloof, right? She didn't really respond to Michael's charms, but he wasn't trying to charm her as much, which was fine, but it wasn't nearly as funny as the first season where he was always trying to pursue her in some way, and she was having none of it. Like, she was the only woman on planet Earth who was like, you are an idiot. I am not going to put up with anything that you tell me, and stop breaking my car.
Now I want to watch Knight Rider. Forget A-Team.
Really, you only need
even to though you told me not to, now I'm going to go watch it.
Only watch the first season. Everything else would just be a disappointment.
So yeah, there were, you know, I am a little younger than you, so I would have been 6 years old in 86. So I don't remember a lot of this. Like, yeah. I remember the Challenger disaster. I mean, I remember Ronald Reagan being president. Any of the like pop culture type stuff, you know, being a little kid. None of that was really on my radar.
I think Miami Vice was going on in 1986, and there was no Miami Vice pictures in there. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Miami Vice was either done by 86 or just about to start in 86. I don't know. But, you know, it's, what, 30 pictures or something like that from 30 years ago? You know, there's pictures of Ollie North, you know, giving his sworn testimony in the Iran-Contra affair and all kinds of other, you know, scandals that seem so important and about ready to topple the government. And 30 years later, they're just footnotes.
Right, they kind of remain in, like, pop culture reference. Like, I've heard jokes before where, you know, Ollie North is somehow plays into the punchline or, you know, plays into like an analogy in a line in a show or something like that. I always think it's interesting when you understand the reference, but you don't really understand what actually happened or the history of it.
Yeah.
And that happens, like, that's one of those. Like, I understand that Oliver North testified it was this big deal. I have no idea what the...
Why?
Why, right?
So it's, the reference survives, but the context is lost.
Right, so there's a picture here of Jim and Tammy Faye Baker.
Yeah.
Over the years, you know, you hear various jokes about Jim and Tammy Faye, that kind of thing. And I understand, you know, that they were televangelists and there were some shady business dealings, whatever. But I don't really understand their backstory or their whole history. But I get why the reference is funny or, you know, why the reference works.
Well, the upside now is with Wikipedia and
you can
minutes,
learn, right?
Right. You can learn at least something.
Yeah.
Right. So that's hooray for the internet revolution.
Totally. You don't have to know anything.
It's almost true.
There's a picture of a young Bill Clinton as the governor of Arkansas.
Yeah, he seems astonishingly young in there. But yeah.
The Bears winning the Super Bowl.
Duh, Bears.
You know, it's interesting. They pulled a picture. So there's a picture of Donald Trump holding an ice skate.
Oh, yeah, because he renovated the ice skating rink.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is probably not a, like, top 30 noteworthy picture of 86, but it's relevant in 2016.
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of interesting. But so here's the funniest thing. 1986, he looks so young, same haircut.
And same kind of... Doesn't he have, like, a scowl on his face, too?
No, but it's kind of a dopey look, like... it's kind of crazy to me. I figured that haircut was something that, like, you know, as a older man, he had same haircut.
Yeah,
1986. I don't know, but yeah, it was cool. I wonder if they've done this before for other years, or if they're gonna do it for every year. That would be really cool.
Yeah, it is kind of a, you know, it's a few minutes diversion. It's a fun thing.
Do you read The Atlantic regularly?
No.
A couple articles we've talked about over the last few weeks have come from The Atlantic, and they've been good, and I've thought I should go back regularly to The Atlantic, but I haven't.
There are several websites that I follow, blogs, I guess the kids call them these days, and they often, you know, they're curating various articles and topics that are of interest to the blog owners, which... are also of interest to me. So that's usually how I come to these things, is someone else has linked to it on a blog and written a blurb. And so I'll read the blurb and say, oh, that's interesting, and then go read the article. It is really interesting that is how news is, for me anyway, often consumed. I work very hard to avoid the major daily news sites simply because their level of bombastic crazy is intolerable to me. I am much happier as an individual by avoiding Fox News, MSNBC, and CNN, right? And even, quite frankly, most of Google News or Yahoo News or any of that stuff, right? Just the day-to-day, you know, stuff coming in off the wires news is, it's a lot of agitation and a lot of noise and not a lot of substance. I'm not completely out of touch with day-to-day events. I listen to the Economist podcast. I used to really love to read the Economist magazine, but I learned when I had a subscription to the Economist magazine that I'm something of a completionist. And, you know, every week the Economist magazine sends you 100 pages of
dense,
fairly
material.
Dense news. And I could not read it fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
And it caused me stress just because I was behind. So I've had to learn to let that go. And I no longer get the subscription to it.
Yeah.
Not because I don't want to read it, just because I can't make myself just read the 20 most interesting articles and recycle the rest of it. So.
And I was just saying, I used to have a subscription to Harper's that was the same way. Like, I loved reading their long form stuff, but it became stressful to finish the magazine
before the next one
would show up.
Yeah.
And then I would end up with a whole stack of them, you know, as if I was ever going to go back through back issues and finish them. And,
yeah. For a while I had my subscription to The Week, which was, again, a weekly magazine that it kind of summarized the week's events. And that was fine. I just didn't end up liking it as well as I liked The Economist. The thing I liked about The Economist was oftentimes I'd read it and then I'd read something about whatever, right? You know, something going on somewhere in the world. And then a couple days later, you might have, the news on public radio on in the car and they start talking about something. You know, a 20-second discussion of it on the radio. And you're like, oh, I read that in last week's Economist, you know, about what's going on in the Ukraine or, you know, this new monetary policy that they're talking about in Japan or whatever it is that was the topic. I would have read it in the Economist. Mm. So, alas, there's not enough hours in the day, it seems.
I did successfully get my New York Times digital subscription canceled.
Really?
I don't remember. We talked about that like a month ago. I ended up paying one more month than I wanted to. And I had to call them on the phone to cancel it during business hours.
Did they give you a hard time?
No, they didn't. But they did. Oh, I just got this offer that popped up for you. You can have a month for 29 cents. And then it'll be back to the normal rate. It's like, nope. I was like, if you have anything where you can give me a discount that's permanent, I'd consider it.
Yeah, or at least like 6 months or something, right?
No, she did have one that was like 3 or 4 months. We can do it for like 4 months at $5.99 and then it'll go back to the $14.99 or whatever.
Yeah.
And I've just decided I'm done with like teaser rates on anything. Like, I'm not going to subscribe to anything that's at a rate that will inflate at a future period in time where I will have forgotten and it will be auto-charged.
Yeah, so those teaser rates are prevalent because they work.
Exactly. On people like me.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's off the list. And I don't really miss it. Like I had said, I like reading the New York Times. The app is pretty good, but I just wasn't getting $15 a month out of it.
Yeah. And the iPad is a, like, when the iPad came out, I'm like, you know, this would be the ideal way to read. Like, it had a good screen on it, especially once it went to a Retina display, right? It has plenty of internal storage. Like, this would be the way to get the paper or a magazine or whatever. And I still believe that. For a year, I got Car and Driver, the auto magazine, as a digital subscription, you know, through the iBooks or whatever it is, right, on the iPad. And it was pretty good. I mean, it was a couple of years ago, and so I think Hearst Publishing is the company that owns that, right? And they were just figuring out how to make it work. So there were occasionally some bumps in how they were doing it, but they were, you know, you could tell that their publishing empire was set up to produce a paper magazine and then also trying to figure out how to deliver the digital magazine was new territory for them. They were figuring it out. And I was willing to tolerate that, but it was, I don't know, $24 or something like that for a year. And I was willing to pay that the first year because I wanted to support the digital, and I thought, they'll probably have some sort of like renew and save whatever, right? But they didn't. Like, it came around again to the next year, and they're like, you know, do you another year, another $24? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you're not shipping me the atoms of the magazine. You're delivering it over an internet connection that I'm paying for to a device that I paid for. Why the $24 when I could, I think at the time, I got a 1-year subscription to the paper magazine for $10 and the mailman has to bring that to my house.
Right.
I know that they want to raise the average selling price for their content because they think it's worth it, but just by choosing to get it printed on paper and shipped to my house to have it cost half as much, I'm like, you know, I'm all about supporting the future, but I can get the magazine and then recycle it, you know, in 6 weeks just as easily as anybody else can. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know why they insist on charging a price that doesn't have any bearing with reality for that stuff. Though I don't know if the New York Times digital price is wildly different than their physical print price.
Well, yeah, it's a lot less expensive than getting the actual paper.
So there it does at least make some sense.
I feel the same way about ebooks. Like when I go to buy a book and it's the Kindle book is the same price as the physical book, I find it very irritating. And I almost want to buy the physical book just to spite them and be like, well, fine, you're going to waste paper and ink and shipping and I'm going to pay the same. But it's like I want the Kindle book.
Yeah.
I just don't want to pay the same price as the hardcover. But
well, yeah, but you know, Apple is the antitrust loser here in this space, right?
Yeah.
He says jokingly. speaking of iPads, so I ordered a new to me iPad yesterday.
So you decided on the Air 2?
Yes.
A refurbed Air 2?
Yes. But I'm picky, so, because, you know, they were available in like 3 different colors, right? So I wanted a 64 gigabyte iPad Air 2, Wi-Fi only, in space gray, which means that I've been obsessively checking the Apple refurb store, you know, every day for 3 or 4 weeks now. And then last night I just randomly checked before I went to bed thinking, there's not going to be anything there. Because I checked earlier than today.
Yeah.
But there it was.
So it's on the way?
It's on the way. Should be here on Friday.
All right.
The and there would be no camera bump. Though the reality is, this thing with tax is like $450. And buying as close to equivalent, because you can't get a 64 gigabyte iPad Pro, 9.7-inch iPad Pro. You can get a 32 or a 128. So since I want 64, I'd have to get the 128. And Wi-Fi only, 128, that's like $750 before tax. So it's probably an $800 device.
Yeah.
it's awesome in lots of ways, right? The screen with its Trutron display and its extra wide color gamut, I'm sure would be astonishing. It's just not worth, you know, the extra $400.
No, not that much value in it.
So,
makes sense.
And, you know, this will be a huge upgrade from my iPad 3.
Yep.
Which was getting long in the tooth. And it was the last 30-pin connector device at my house. So finally I could get rid of all of those stupid 30-pin cables sitting all over the place. And now everything will be lightning. Just in time for Apple to change everything to USB-C.
Right.
Did you see Intel has... they've started to suggest that... they're working on updating the specification to send digital audio for headphones out of USB-C.
Hmm.
So, you know, Intel, who makes USB-C chipsets, of course, wants that connector to be the one that rules them all. I haven't seen anybody talking about new iPhones with a USB-C connector, but you could imagine that a USB-C connector, because it is... either up or down, mm-hmm. right? It's not directional, might be something that could satisfy Apple's needs for a connector on the bottom of a phone. It's an intriguing thought.
Way back when we talked about the audio jack going away, that made sense to me at the time, that that's the point at which they would transition to a single port was for USB-C.
Yeah.
That's not going to be the case for this fall, so either, you know, it's going to be over lightning or they're not going to get rid of the headphone jack. So
maybe I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's almost a loser's game to try to predict what Apple's going to do mm-hmm. in the future. I don't think you have to get rid of the headphone jack in order to make the phones thinner. But I can understand the argument of getting rid of the headphone jack to save space inside the case.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there are a bunch of iPhone 6 and 6S owners who would gladly give up their headphone jack for that much more battery and not have to have the weird battery hump.
Right.
You know, case on it, but what else you got to talk about?
I am all talked out. I got nothing.
Well, lesson is, when the coffee runs out, Scott runs down. Okay. Take care.
All right.